Hamas political bureau chief says that the Palestinians' priority is to stop the brutal aggression against Gaza and full withdrawal of occupation forces. International aid agencies warning about the serious repercussions of a decision by some Western countries to cut funding to UNRWA. And Palestinians condemn the assassination of three young men by Israeli undercover forces in a West Bank hospital as a heinous crime against humanity. This is News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says any deal with the Tel Aviv regime must stop the brutal aggression in Gaza and end up in the full withdrawal of occupation forces. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh says the movement is open to negotiations, but an agreement must include an end to the Israeli siege, as well as a genuine prisoner exchange. He made those comments in reaction to a new ceasefire proposal put forward after talks in Paris. The Islamic Jihad movement also said it would not engage in any prisoner exchange deal without a comprehensive ceasefire and Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. The Israeli regime, meantime, has hit residential buildings across Gaza, killing more than 200 people in a matter of a day. 20 people, mostly women and children, were killed in a strike targeting a building in Gaza City. Warplanes also bombed the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, while residential buildings in the southern city of Khan Yunis were also shelled. The death toll now standing at more than 26,700. The head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says the healthcare system in Gaza is on the brink of collapse. Officials in Al Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis say they have suspended surgeries due to lack of oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been a central target of Israeli attacks. The regime forces have also struck ambulances marked with Red Cross or Red Crescent emblem, often in proximity to hospitals. Motia Abu Musabeh joined us a short while ago with an update on the situation in the war-torn territory.
It's the same scenario that took place in the Shifa complex and the hospitals of the northern parts of Gaza Strip. It's now reiterated in Khan Yunis city, which means that the Israeli occupation forces systematically attempting to paralyze the health sector and collapse the health sector inside Gaza Strip. In the surrounding areas of the complex, these moments and over the last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks. The Israeli airstrikes have never stopped for a while the Israeli artillery maintained their constant shelling towards those areas, while the Israeli occupation forces on the ground demanding the Palestinian people to evacuate from those areas to Rafah and to Deir el-Balah city, under the claims that those areas are still safe. In Rafah city, the Israeli occupation forces as well kept attacking the city, and they opened their fire to the eastern parts of the city.
Israeli undercover forces have staged a deadly attack on a hospital in the occupied West Bank, killing three Palestinians. Disguised as medical staff and women, the troops stormed the Ibn Sina Hospital in the city of Jenin. Israel claimed that the victims had ties to Hamas. Hospital officials said the young men were assassinated while sleeping. Following that raid, a general strike was announced in Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry also called on the UN to stop Israel's daily string of crimes against Palestinians and health centers. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry described it as a heinous crime against humanity. Hamas also denounced the attack, saying it won't go unpunished. Iran has strongly condemned what it calls a barbaric act, saying it could pave the way for normalization of organized terrorism in the world. Now, several international aid agencies have warned about the serious repercussions of a decision by main donors to cut funding to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Some 20 NGOs have censured the move as reckless, warning the decision would endanger many civilian lives. The UNRWA also said it would be unable to continue operations in Gaza and across the region after February in case funding does not resume. The UN body has lost half of its budget. More than 15 countries, including the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and Canada, have suspended funding. And that after Israel accused some of the UNRWA staff in Gaza of taking part in anti-Israeli operations. Meantime, Palestinians have condemned the pause in funding for UNRWA as an unjust decision amid the worsening humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip.
We say that it is a condemned and hasty decision. It is a decision that punishes everyone. If what they are saying is correct, that 12 employees participated in October 7 attacks, it is their right after all, as people defending their land. But you don't hold accountable 7 million Palestinians in this collective punishment.
This step that the U.S. and some European countries took unfortunately came as a response to the demand of the Zionist enemy, and therefore it will affect the services of the UNRWA agency that already suffers from a severe lack of funding.
They want to destroy us. They want to destroy the Palestinian people, be it in Palestine, be it in the diaspora, or wherever they are. They surely won't be able to. They stepped into the humanitarian and economic phase. This decision that countries took to pause funding to UNRWA is certainly an unjust decision and can't pass.
We are basically not receiving aid now. So what will happen after the U.S. and other countries cut their funding to the UNRWA? This would mean a humanitarian catastrophe, and it means that the U.S. and its allies are participating in the war of slaughter against the Palestinian people and the killing of the children, elderly, and women in Gaza.
I am sure that there will be a famine or even a disaster here because we are already living in disastrous conditions in Gaza due to the lack of aid.
Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah have been engaged in intense fighting since Israel launched its onslaught on Gaza in early October. Hezbollah says it's targeted a gathering of IOF troops in Hadab Yaron with missiles, inflicting some losses. Our Lebanon correspondent joined us earlier with details.
It was also very significant that we see that Hezbollah is targeting soldiers directly. We can see how, despite the fact that the Israelis are doing their best to basically move with caution and trying to be careful not to be under the rocket fire of Hezbollah, still it seems Hezbollah has the upper hand when it comes to these capabilities of being able to target the movement and know exactly the movement of the Israeli soldiers, where they are, when they are moving from away from the barracks or into the barracks, and be able to target them. That was, of course, one of the operations. Another operation was near the town of Wazani, and facing the town of Wazani, which is also very close to the occupied Shabab farms. Hezbollah says it targeted espionage devices in that posts specifically. And this is not the first time that Hezbollah targets espionage devices. We've seen that one of their main strategies and tactics that was used also all across the border was that the first thing that they did during the early days of the confrontation, even before the truce, was the fact that they made sure to target everything that is used by the Israelis in order to spy on Lebanon, to take footage, whether it is the cameras or the espionage devices, in order to that are used to jam radios and to spy not only and eavesdrop not only on Lebanon, but also that could reach areas in Syria and Cyprus and even Turkey.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the sanctions and animosity of the ill-wishers could be an opportunity for further scientific progress in the country. Meeting with economic players and producers, Ayatollah Khamenei said that such problems undoubtedly deal a blow to the country and put into trouble, but the leader stressed that the young generation has turned those problems into opportunities as they have been able to develop military munitions and secure outstanding scientific achievements in such areas as space and also satellite launches. Ayatollah Khamenei added that had it not been for those sanctions, Iran would not have achieved such accomplishments. Tehran and Islamabad have vowed to jointly fight the common threat of terrorism. The announcement signals efforts to rebuild ties following missile attacks on each other's border regions. Yassoum Shahmedi reports.
Very dear brother.
Vowing to fight the common threat of terrorism and reiterating their commitment to improving bilateral relations, Iran and Pakistan are back on the right track to boost ties following tit-for-tat missile attacks on each other's border regions, where terrorist separatist groups have been active.
We are saying this loud and clear for the terrorists to listen carefully. Iran and Pakistan will not allow terrorists to create insecurity in the region. Make no mistake, we are one nation in two different geographical areas, and both sides strongly respect each other's territorial integrity.
In Islamabad, in response to his Pakistani counterpart's official invitation, Hossein Amir Abdullahian discussed ways to fight against the terrorists based along the Iran-Pakistan border areas that are, in his words, supported by hostile third countries. Many Iranian and Pakistani forces have lost their lives in recent years in the fight against terrorism, and over the past 2 weeks, both Iran and Pakistan inevitably launched missile attacks on each other's soil in order to contain the terrorist separatist groups, a move that created a media frenzy. And now this official visit is clearing things out.
You need to understand that in the last 70 years or so, Pakistan and Iran have developed a robust cooperation between themselves. We have strong people-to-people contacts. We have religious ties. We have historical ties. We have cultural ties between our two countries. And these ties are extremely important for our two countries to have a common security and common development, peace and prosperity for each other. I think the important thing for us is that there is a strong sentiment in Pakistan that peace and prosperity and security of Iran is something which is extremely important for Pakistan and for the region. And we have very strong reason to believe that Iran is also motivated by the same sentiment.
Views that were reiterated by Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff, General Sayed Asim Munir, as well as Pakistan's Prime Minister, Anwar ul Haq Kakar, who urged joint efforts, more coordination, and intelligence sharing to fight terrorism as a common threat to both countries, while also extending an official invitation for the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to travel to Islamabad.
Iran and Pakistan are turning a new page, and the Iranian foreign minister's trip to Islamabad is a sign that both sides are adamant in expanding their bilateral relations. Gisumi Shahmadi, Islamabad.
The Iranian foreign minister says that the U.S. knows well that a political solution is needed to end the Israeli war and genocide in Gaza and the current crisis in West Asia. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a message posted on social media, said the diplomacy is moving forward to end the crises, though. He also underlined that the Israeli prime minister is nearing the end of his criminal political life. Also, Iran's representative, an ambassador to UN, rejected his baseless U.S. allegations linking Iran to attacks on American facilities and personnel. In a letter to the Security Council, Amir Saeed Iravani said Tehran does not directly or indirectly control any group or individual in the region and is not responsible for their actions either. On that, after the U.S. blamed Iran-backed groups for a weekend attack that killed three American forces in Jordan. The Iranian Defense Ministry says that the country's space program is completely scientific, aimed at developing technology for civil and peaceful purposes. The spokesman of the Space Department at the Defense Ministry, Ahmad Hosseini Munis, reiterated Tehran's legitimate right to make scientific advancements in aerospace. Hosseini also censured negative reactions to Iran's breakthroughs in the field and the recent successful launch of multiple satellites into orbit. He said that such reactions are due to some countries' concerns about Iran breaking up their monopolies in the field. He also revealed that Iran will launch more satellites in the near future. On Sunday, for the first time, the country managed to place three indigenous satellites into orbit simultaneously using the Seymour carrier. In our explainer program, Mehdi Abbasian elaborates on Iran's recent satellite launches and the course of progress of its space program.
Iran has successfully launched not one, two, but three satellites into orbit simultaneously. That is quite a feat for a country that stands second in having the most number of U.S. and Western sanctions against it. Yet it really shows how far Iran's space program has come when it comes to satellite launches. To get a better idea about Iran's space program and satellite advancement, we have to go back to the year Iran's space agency was established. That was year 2004. And 19 years ago, within 5 years, Iran became an orbital launch-capable nation in 2009. This meant Iran belongs to the club of a dozen countries that have this capability, such as Russia, North Korea, and India. Omid was Iran's first satellite, which went into orbit in February 2009 using a domestic launcher, the Safir. Omid, which means hope in Persian, was a data processing satellite for research and telecommunications. Keep in mind that there is a difference between the satellite itself and the launcher as seen in this picture. Now, in recent years, Iran has made great strides in the field of science and technology, especially when it comes to space program. Iran is now among the top 10 nations in the world that are capable of producing and launching satellites into space. Here are some of the other major satellites that Iran has developed and launched successfully over the years, like the Simorgh, Safir, and Surush. In all, 21 satellites have been launched, and some highlights throughout the years. In 2012, Navid satellite was launched. It was the third satellite that Iran launched successfully, domestically made satellite into orbit. In 2020, Nur was the first military satellite that was launched into space. Also in August 2023, Iran launched Khayyam, a high-resolution imaging satellite. Although parallels can be drawn between Iran's satellite production and the military's missile production, Iran's space activity and the Ministry of Defense is non-military. Iran has become one of the leading countries in the world when it comes to missile production, like short-range missiles and intermediate and long-range ones. Some can have distances of up to 2,500 kilometers, which includes missiles like Shahab, Fateh, and Zulfaqar, as well as Simorgh, a launch vehicle capable of placing a 350-kilogram payload 500 kilometers into Earth's orbit. All of Iran's satellite launches have been newsmakers, but always been frowned upon by the West, in particular the U.S., who has accused Iran of going after nuclear weaponization of its peaceful satellite program. Take the two recent launches, Soraya satellite, a research satellite. It was launched with a Qaem-100 space launch vehicle, a three-stage SLV with solid fuel. It went 750 kilometers above Earth in around between 7 to 11 minutes. Germany, France, and Britain condemned Iran's achievement. No surprise there. Surely, they didn't anticipate what came next, the launch of three satellites into orbit simultaneously. Minimum altitude, 450 kilometers, and a maximum of 1,100 kilometers above the Earth's surface. The names Mahda, Hatif, and Kayhan. They were launched from Imam Khomeini Space Launch Terminal in Semnan province by the Simorgh satellite launch vehicle. It is pretty obvious sanctions have not dented Iran's space program or curtailed what is the Islamic Republic's inalienable right. But Iran's leader has rightly noted that the West's frustration is due to the scientific advancement of Iran's scientists, especially from the younger generation responsible for catapulting Iran's space program into an advanced stage.
Now, China has warned the U.S. against further fueling tensions in the region following a deadly attack on a U.S. military base in Jordan. Beijing says Washington should avoid falling into a vicious circle of retaliation. All right, with that, we come to the end of this newscast from Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The turn of events in recent months amid the Zionist regime genocidal war on the Gaza Strip has demonstrated to the world the awe-inspiring bravery and heroism of the Yemeni government and its military. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Press TV wrote, the Ansarullah resistance movement, which is currently running the affairs of the Arab country, including its military, has walked out of its way to express solidarity with the people of Palestine. A series of attacks on Israel-linked vessels in the Red Sea, as well as vessels belonging to the US and the UK by the Yemeni military, has prompted major shipping companies to avoid the strategic waterway, inflicting a heavy blow to the Zionist regime's already fledgling economy. With the Ansarullah resistance movement the topic of discussion around the world, some erroneously calling it an Iranian proxy, it's necessary to put things into proper perspective. The analysis of Ansarullah, known in the West as Houthis, and its relations with the Islamic Republic is often not understood outside the political discourse known as sponsor proxy. This doctrine questions the autonomy of the Yemeni group by dubbing it as a tool in the hands of Iran. According to this Western doctrine, Iran as a state uses its power to control the Yemeni group. This is a political relationship based on a revolutionary vision articulated around Islam between the Islamic Republic as a defender of oppressed nations worldwide and the Yemeni resistance group. Ansarullah's rejection of Saudi interference in the country is explained by the sense of oppression and absence of justice that the people of Yemen felt and complained about for years. It was precisely this rejection, anchored in a political dimension with Islamic origins, which explains the repeated uprisings against the former Saudi-backed government in Yemen between 2004 and 2010. In 2011, the grievances of the Yemeni population reached a critical point, leading to massive protests demanding the resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had ruled the country with an iron hand for over 30 years. After Saleh's exit, Saudi Arabia backed Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi as the new leader of the Arab country. Ansarullah and the people of Yemen rejected his election and launched a popular uprising against the new Saudi-backed government, which was followed by the Saudi-led coalition's aggression. Since 2015, the Ansarullah-led government has been administering the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, as well as most of the Red Sea coast, and has followed a pragmatic foreign policy driven by regional interest. The Yemeni government has particularly opposed the presence of foreign forces in the region, including the United States, and strongly advocated the liberation of Palestine from the Zionist occupation. In this regard, it's important to understand that Yemen's support for the Palestinian cause is not limited to the Ansarullah group's unflinching support for the Palestinian cause. As early as 1947, the then British colony of Aden, southern Yemen, one of the first public demonstrations against British rule, took the form of a three-day strike against Britain's pro-Zionist policies in Palestine. The following year, Yemen became one of the early members of the United Nations. Its delegation joined representatives from five other Arab states in leaving the UN General Assembly Hall when the vote for the partition of Palestine was passed. It can be said, therefore, that the issue of Palestine has served as an anti-colonial catalyst throughout Yemen's contemporary history. For instance, during its 27 years of existence, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen consistently supported Palestinian movements, with a particular emphasis on left-wing Palestinian organizations. In 1971, it allowed the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine to attack an Israeli ship in Bab el-Mandab. 2 years later, it closed the Bab el-Mandab to Israeli maritime traffic to assist Egypt in the war against the Zionist regime. In 1979, when Egyptian leader Anwar Sadat recognized the Zionist regime and signed the Camp David Accords, the response from PDRY included the expulsion of Egyptian teachers from the country except for those from the Egyptian left-wing opposition. After the unification of Yemen in 1990, Saleh's regime continued to recognize and support Palestine. In 2015, after the involvement of foreign states in the Arab country, the situation changed. Factions backed by Saudi Arabia and the UAE continued to support the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah, while the Ansarullah resistance movement and the government it runs has strongly backed Palestinian resistance groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad. This support from the Yemeni group for Palestinian resistance groups serves to explain the importance of identity in political terms in order to understand the relations between Iran and Ansarullah.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
So now that we understand that everything that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does, and continues to do is by default beautiful, then how do we end up being people who consistently see the beauty of God in everything, right? And that's what we want to get to, that I see beauty in everything. There are three things we'll talk about, Number one, we have to accept that everything that comes from God is beautiful. The second point when it comes to trying to see everything as beautiful is by actively engaging in those things which will beautify our existence, right? And so there are a bunch of things, right? So like number one, start with the bare minimum, beautifying ourselves, dressing nicely, looking pleasant, right? Smelling pleasant, right? These simple things can have an entire shift in our view of things, right? If I feel good, naturally I will think better, right? And this is not something that, like, we're just making up. Man, we have so many traditions on this regard, right? For example, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, says, "Inna Allah Ta'ala Jamilun Yuhibbul Jamal," that indeed Allah is beautiful and He loves beauty. Yeah. وَيُحِبُّ أَنْ يَرَى أَثَرَ نِعْمَتِهِ عَلَىٰ عَبْدِهِ وَيُبْغِذُ الْبَعُوسَ التَّبَاؤُسِ. And he says, and he likes to see the evidence of that beauty in his creation. That means, make yourself look pleasant. Yeah, make yourself look presentable. And the hadith continues, he loathes misery and pretending to be miserable. Right? So, you know, like, we all have, like, our sick pajamas, you know, our sick sweats. Like, you know, like, as soon as I put those on, my wife's like, something's wrong, yeah? Because we have our sick clothes, right? Well, then, if that's what I have, then those should be only for that, yeah? Not because I feel out of it today, so I know, right? Like, there are things that happen, like, we have to fight off the desire of being down sometimes. Sometimes we're down, yeah? But I can't compound the internal feeling with external equality of that. You know what I mean by that or no? So, like, externally, I don't shave then for a week. Externally, I don't comb my hair. Externally, I don't shower. I wear all of these sick clothes just because internally I don't feel good right now. No. If you force yourself externally to fight off that internal feeling, you will be able to shake off that feeling of not feeling good. Yeah, you understand? The external has an effect on the internal. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? And so I externally fight off these things that are internally giving flame. Yeah, giving like oxygen to the fire that I feel inside. So that's number one. Now obviously this Jamal has conditions, right? Our sixth Imam says, same tradition. He says, Albas wa tajmal. Dress and beautify yourselves, he says. Dress and beautify yourselves. Fa inna Allaha jamilun yuhibbul jamal wa la yakun min halalin. This is important, yeah? That it has to be in a halal way. So know your rules. There are certain things like you can't wear. We can't wear. I can't wear certain type of things, right? And that's evident enough. So there is the expectation of looking presentable within the framework of halal, right? And so that's number one. But more importantly than external nature, and this is really important for a lot of us, is to beautify our akhlaq. Yeah? Our akhlaq, right? Our akhlaq, right? The way we treat each other, the way I conduct myself, you know? Sometimes I just don't feel like smiling. No, smile. Life's hard. Yeah? Life's hard, man. Like, you know, it's not easy, but there is an expectation of behavior that has been given to us by the Prophet. Live up to that even if you don't feel like living up to that at that moment. The Prophet has this beautiful tradition. He says, خَيْرُ مَا أُعْطِيَ الرَّجُلُ الْمُؤْمِنُ خُلْقُ الْحَسَنُ. The best thing given to a believer is good akhlaq, good character. وَالشَّرُّ مَا أُعْطِيَ الرَّجُلُ. And the worst thing that can be given to a person, قَلْبُ سُوءٍ فِي سُورَةٍ حَسَنَةٍ. Yeah? A bad heart, but a beautiful face. Worst thing that can be given to a person. Yeah? We concentrate on how we look externally. All the time. Right? But we're not looking to see what kind of akhlaq do we have. Beautify our akhlaq. Yeah? Beautify it. Man, that's one of the hardest things to do in this world, is to have consistent good akhlaq. Yeah? If it was easy, my brothers and sisters, we would all be at the highest levels of iman, because that's what takes us to the highest levels of iman. If you ever wonder why we haven't reached that highest levels of iman, it's not because of the salah, we do it every day. Yeah? It's not because of the fast, we do it every Shahr Ramadan. It's because we are not yet consistent in our akhlaq. Yeah? Not saying we have bad akhlaq. We're just not consistent in our good akhlaq. Yeah? If we had consistency in good akhlaq, the traditions are overwhelming that it will raise you to the highest stations of spirituality. Yeah, the highest stations of closeness to Allah. Do it. Yeah, fight the desire just to be grumpy with the desire of wanting to be good. And then the third aspect of this beautification is to beautify our actions and our duties to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by adding heart and soul to the things that we do. Yeah, this is important. So it's not just about me. That's one aspect. Me wearing nice clothes when I pray. That's one aspect. Me smelling nice when I pray. That's one aspect. Me making sure that my qira'at is good. That's one aspect. Me making sure that my ruku is good. My sujoods are good. They are long. They are nice. Nice du'a. That's all one aspect. But there's another aspect of there being heart in my salah. Yeah? That's what adds beauty to our salah. When I know who I'm praying to. Yeah? When there is humility in my salah. When there is thought in my salah. I'm not just doing this so that I can be done with it, so I can do something else after this. No, that's not the mindset of one who has heart in their salah. Right? And it's this heart in salah that distinguishes us from others, right? So that's the second point in all of these different forms. The first one, as we said, was to accept that everything that comes from God is beautiful. Everything. The second is to actively engage in those things that are loved by God. God loves us looking good. God loves us with good akhlaq. God loves us when we put heart into things. So we engage in those things which God loves because they are beautiful to Him. The third is, and this is the third final thing that I said, we saw three things. We need to develop characteristics that will aid us in seeing the beauty in everything. Yeah? So the first, it goes back to that first point, where we say we have to see the beauty in everything. Not easy to do so. But if I have this third point, which is I have characteristics that God wants in me, it will aid me in seeing beauty in everything.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In Britain, local authorities and charities are urging the government to extend its Household Support Fund scheme, which was first introduced in autumn of 2021 and distributed among local councils to help those in need during the cost of living crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of iNews has covered this story and tells us more. UK councils warned free school meals during holidays will likely be withdrawn for hundreds of thousands of school pupils after Easter due to the end of government funding. Local authorities and charities are urging the government to extend its Household Support Fund scheme, which was first introduced in autumn of 2021 and distributed among local councils to help those in need during the cost of living crisis. Originally set to last until spring of 2022, the scheme had been extended three times, taking the total amount of funding to £2.5 billion, while England was given a further £842 million in April of 2023 in order to support those in need. However, the fund was not mentioned in the autumn statement by the Chancellor and is now due to come to an end on 31st of March. The scheme has been used by local councils to fund free school meal vouchers during the holidays, which has become a lifeline for low-income families during and since the pandemic, and takes up much of the money local authorities receive through the scheme. Beverly Craig, leader of Manchester City Council, said, "It is heartbreaking to think that her local authority will no longer be able to fund free school meal vouchers and other cost of living support when the fund comes to an end." She said, "We're a city that has historic levels of poverty and deprivation, often overlooked. Over 43% of our kids are growing up in poverty. Council analysis has shown that 20% of Manchester residents have a disposable income of less than £30 a month after rent, food and bills." Beverly Craig said, "Last year alone, the city spent over £50 million alleviating poverty and dealing with the cost of living crisis," adding that the council has been assisted this year by a Household Support Fund grant of £12.9 million. Councillor Craig said that this has enabled the council to help 60,000 people, including 40,000 children, receiving free school meal vouchers outside of term time, 12,500 vulnerable households getting cost of living support payments, 6,000 children benefiting from a holiday activity fund, and 400 caregivers accessing a boost to their income. Beverly Craig said, "So for a city like us, losing out on the household support fund, it really is a problem. The 60,000 people that we're able to support in addition to all of the work that we're doing around poverty stops overnight." She added, "We're seeing vulnerable families who had a little bit of money tucked away for a rainy day have spent the rainy day money." Manchester City Council is calling for a year-long extension to the Household Support Fund, considering that economic forecasts suggest that the situation may have improved slightly by this time next year. But obviously, there's a longer-term discussion that this should be mainstreamed into budgets. Bella Sankey, the leader of Brighton and Hove City Council, which together with councils in Plymouth, Lambeth, Bristol and Southampton, has written to the government to stress the importance of the Household Support Fund, said that she has been horrified by what she has seen and heard in local food banks. She said, "Demand is now out of control, completely outstripping supply, like nothing that has ever been experienced before. The amount of discretionary food vouchers we would previously give out over the course of a year during COVID now goes out the door in just 1 month." She added, "The concern is that people are clearly going without food," adding that the situation could potentially be having an impact on school attendance, as she has heard from one parent who was terrified about their child going to secondary school and needing to find the money to pay their bus fare. She said, "Those are the sorts of calculations and decisions people are having to make." Graham Witham, the Chief Executive Officer of Greater Manchester Poverty Action, said that the Household Support Fund has been really important, adding that the Free School Meals Council have been able to provide during holidays has helped build a safety net for families. Graham Witham said, "The other side of it is that councils themselves are cash-strapped and don't have a significant ring-fence funding for welfare provision. So this has just been massive. It's enabled councils to stand up to responses to need that they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And it's created some space for innovation as well." He said he believes that historically government has washed its hand of local welfare provision, but that the Household Support Fund helped it to understand the value of the role that local authorities have. Graham Witham, the CEO of Greater Manchester Poverty Action, sees the end of the funding as a big cliff edge because cost of living support payment from the government ends in March as well. He called for permanent ring-fence funding for local welfare provision by local councils. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Lynn Perry, the chief executive of the British charity Barnardo's, said, "Across the United Kingdom, families are struggling to pay their bills or feed their children, often borrowing money and taking on debt just to get through another week. It's vital that the Household Support Fund continues." Lynn Perry added, "The fund ends in March of 2024, so time is running out. Without renewal, it will leave a major hole in local crisis support." Leeds City Council Executive Member for Communities, Mary Harland, said the situation is looking pretty grim without the Household Support Fund, adding that, "Despite being an economically vibrant city, we do still have something like 22% of our population living in poverty, including 35,000 individuals or one in five children." She said, "The Household Support Fund has helped Leeds City boost what it offers through its welfare support scheme, which provides food and fuel vouchers, white goods and help with building maintenance," adding that it is a vital scheme. Gespil, an organisation which works with vulnerable young people across the city, told the local council that it had been able to top up the gas meter of a family living in one of the most deprived areas of the city of Leeds, who had not had heating for several weeks and whose children had been off school with colds and other illnesses. A report published recently by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation found that informal carers are 8% more likely to be living in poverty than those with no caring responsibilities, at 28% compared to 20%. Dominic Carter, Director of Policy and Public Affairs at Carter's Trust, said, "We need to think about what the Household Support Fund being taken away might mean for people like that. What else will they have to go without? We know that for a large number of unpaid carers, they put family members first, often to the detriment of their own health and their own well-being." It comes as council leaders have also called for reform of local government finance and an end to short-term measures after Community Secretary Michael Gove confirmed authorities will receive £500 million in emergency funding for social care. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023, a week before the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her. This day is celebrated as Women's Day in Iran. So what I want to say is that with regard to spiritual journeying, spiritual ascension, and true human values, gender is not important at all. except in certain cases where one gender is preferred over the other, and that is a preference for women over men, as far as I have seen, and I have not seen anything besides this. These are the places where a person's gender does not matter. It is the same with regard to the principle of social responsibilities. Imam Khomeini said somewhere that it is a woman's duty to be involved in politics and to address the fundamental issues of the country. They have a right and a duty to be involved. So he made it obligatory for women to actively participate in shaping the country's destiny and to address the country's fundamental issues. And this itself has a long chapter continuing in it, meaning there is no difference between men and women in these areas.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Regarding being involved in the affairs of the society, it is said, whoever wakes up in the morning without caring about the affairs of the Muslim community is not a Muslim. Is not a Muslim addresses both men and women. When you wake up in the morning, whether you are a housewife, an office worker, an employee, or a craftswoman, whatever it is that you do, you must have the society in mind. You should care about the state of the society. Now, how much you can help and play a role may vary. Each person can play a role, and this effort is required for everyone. This action, effort, and caring is required for everyone. Gender does not matter here either. Another example may be seen in the hadith, whoever hears someone cry out, "O Muslims!" The woman who just spoke here said, the way is closed regarding the matter of Palestine and Gaza. Otherwise, we would have gone if we could have. For example, imagine this woman, who is a doctor, could have gone there and attended to the sick, the injured, the woman, and the children. Everyone has their own role to play. But the important thing is that everyone must make an effort, has a duty, and should have a sense of responsibility regardless of whether they are male or female.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.